This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as part of our ongoing series on COVID-19, I've invited a distinguished clinician. He's a functional medicine chiropractor, a good colleague of mine here in New York City. Lauren Marks is a New York chiropractor. He's a graduate of New York Chiropractic College and a functional medicine specialist serving New York and the surrounding communities in New York. He and I are both locked down amidst the coronavirus emergency, but I thought I would have a discussion with him about some of the functional medicine implications of immunity and dealing with the current coronavirus crisis. He has tremendous experience in working with a wide variety of patients, and I think has an interesting perspective to share. So, Lauren, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ron. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, anything we can do to share information, to support our audience and people is really where it's at. We're all locked down, but we all want to know more.
Indeed. And so there is a sort of a controversy brewing around COVID-19 and the implication of diet and supplements. And frankly, and you've seen some of these articles sort of decry the claims that we can somehow, quote, boost our immune system through the use of various supplements, through the use of special diets. A lot of people are poo-pooing that. They're saying, in fact, look, this is a crisis. You know, we're told to lock down. Everybody is stressed out. It's a time to, you know, maybe be a little less stringent in terms of our personal habits. Because comfort food is sort of a balm to our souls these days, when we're experiencing all kinds of stress and anxiety. Do you have a different view on this? Is it your belief that there are some natural things that we can do to support our immune systems and perhaps not vanquish the virus, make us bulletproof, but, you know, perhaps make it less likely we're going to end up in the intensive care unit on a ventilator, perhaps with a very, very terrible outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you bring up a very interesting point, which begs to, approach the issue of old school medicine versus scientific data that actually can be supported. In medicine, they do what they do. And in integrative medicine, we see the benefit of what all the science that they bring forth, but they seem to make a demarcation when it comes to nutrition as if that is something that is on, you know, extemporaneous. It's not something that's part and parcel with the normal implications in the management of infectious disease processes. And the truth is that now more than ever, it's even more important.
There's certainly a quest now for a drug cocktail, a vaccine, the use of convalescent serum. And, you know, and I'm sure you agree with me, you know, we're all for finding out what high-tech pharmacological methods can be used to, you know, save patients' lives, literally on the front line.
Oh, yeah.
So we're not going to discard these approaches.
No, not at all. Not at all. The whole point is integration. So Let them do their due diligence and let them help the world and let us do our due diligence and let's add to that. There's so much that we could say about this, but we have to start somewhere. But the first thing I'd like to do is to actually acknowledge all the frontline healthcare workers that put themselves on the line every day in taking care of all of these sick people, really at the risk of their own lives, and my hat is off to you, because that's a whole different aspect of medicine. That's not controversy. That's one. And because the latitude of where we could go with this conversation could be so diverse, I thought that we would start with taking a look at why do some people develop fulminant SARS-CoV-19 mm-hmm. disease, and while others develop mild symptoms?
And indeed, there's some real interesting clues there, because as we look at the statistics, we see what are called comorbidities coming into play. I mean, certainly age has something to do with it, but yet there are survivors who are centenarians. There's just a person who recovered who was 103.
Right.
So also there's this salient fact that we're seeing a lot of this in among poorer minorities. Perhaps there's something about their poverty or, the work conditions that they're exposed to. That expose them to a lot of virus, or perhaps, and we know this, that, this is kind of the reverse of what used to happen historically, is that in the old days, rich people were fat and diabetic, and poor people were hungry, so they were slim and fit. We've flipped the script on that these days.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think it was published today. If it wasn't today, it was yesterday, but I think it was today. NYU just did an interim study that they published here in New York State, trying to compile the data of all the people that have been exposed, that have died. And when it came to the comorbidities, they said that the number one factor was obesity.
Okay.
And when we look at that, and we look at the American public in large, and we look at how many people are obese, and that number is expanding, that's quite a significant risk factor associated as a comorbidity. But so we have to look at that, and we have to say, why do some people get so sick and why do others have resilience? And mm-hmm. I think that a good operative term would be to say, what is the terrain in which you bring to this situation when in fact or if you get infected with this or any other infectious process? And obesity being one of them, but hypertension was on the top of the list. And if we're going to look at these comorbidities and the prevalence in society, these are very significant numbers of people that are suffering from these processes. It's not just the smoker or the one that has asthma or COPD. So hypertension, obesity, and the list goes on, and they tiered it according to the number of subjects that were tested against the number of people that didn't fare well. And hopefully there's a silver lining behind all of this, in that there is a shift in consciousness of the American people to the diet and the lifestyle in which they lead that contributes towards that terrain state that you exist in, and your susceptibility to this infection and other illnesses in your trajectory of life.
Indeed, and this is a very ancient concept, because in the 1800s in France, there was a lively debate going on between a fellow who remember very well historically as the author of the germ theory, Louis Pasteur, and some of his intellectual foes. You know, they used to, they didn't have the internet, they didn't have, cable TV then, or movies. And so actually one of the recreational pastimes of intelligent Parisians was to go to lecture halls and hear debates between prominent scientists. So they had Louis Pasteur pitted against his arch rival, Antoine Béchamp. It was kind of like a heavyweight bout, and one argued for the germ theory and said, these are the germs that are causing that, this is really where it's at. And the other guy, Antoine Béchamp, said famously, the microbes are nothing. It is the terrain that matters. And of course, neither, you know, had the absolute truth there. Both were partially right. I mean, I don't think I would, you know, I'm on an excellent diet and I exercise, I get good sleep and take vitamins, but I don't think I'd sign up for an injection of Ebola virus because I'm, you know, so resilient. You know, I don't think that's necessarily a good idea. I think there really is something to the germ theory. Pasteur had it right.
No doubt.
But, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, 100%, and it's a blend of the two. But if we would look at the germ theory, which, you know, by and large medicine has done and approaches infectious diseases on that basis and is not looking at the terrain at this current time and significance, then I think that's where the fault lies. And as we get into this conversation, there's some really interesting data that supports it. You know, and when we talk about, you know, nutritional intervention, I want to bring up that we're talking about science-based interventions. This is not anecdotal stuff. This is not, you know, information that is just, a couple of doctors in practice have done this. Well, that's not enough of a case basis in order to substantiate a claim. There's a lot of science behind vitamin A and vitamin D and zinc and so forth. As a matter of fact, one of the mechanisms with the chloroquine is that it functions as a ionomer and that it helps bring the zinc into the cell.
It ferries the zinc into the cell where it can do its work, its antiviral effects.
Right. Yeah. So if your baseline of zinc, if your serum baseline of zinc is insufficient, then even the drug can't do its job. So this is a perfect marriage between understanding the relationship of your nutritional status and the infectious process.
Indeed. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this message with you. Are you looking to give your immune system a boost? This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with a natural solution from Future Farm Botanicals, liquid wild oil of oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's wild oil of oregano supports a variety of health benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate wild oil of oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. Future Farm sources this product from the Mediterranean and produces it in the United States. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to our guest, Dr. Lauren Marks. So there are certain factors that are involved in what's called innate immunity, which is, you know, our bulwark against diseases that we haven't yet encountered. I mean, acquired immunity means later, you know, maybe the people who've had this will acquire immunity to it, or they'll develop a vaccine which can induce acquired immunity. But that takes, you know, weeks and weeks to develop. What we need is we need all the innate immunity we can to resist the docking of the virus on our cells, and then this cascade that leads to inflammation and organ failure and, you know, going on a ventilator, all that stuff.
Right. So when I said, why do some people develop, you know, fulminant disease with this infection and others develop mild symptoms from a cold to a little bit of a fever and then a cough and then it just goes away? And so I dug a little deeper into that, and there were four primary things to date that I have in my research been able to come up with. And one is, which was my thought was about genetic predispositions. And then I needed to back that up and see if there was a, you know, founding relationship there. And I found three pertinent genes that are related. And then we want to look at the nutritional status prior to exposure of people. We want to factor in the comorbidities with associated inflammatory states. And the reason I make that statement is because things like obesity hold with them that person's systemic level of inflammation is higher than the person that does not have these comorbidities. And if your baseline of inflammation is statistically higher than a healthier person, and then an infection like the COVID that produces such an inflammatory cascade, once it takes off, here you are at a great disadvantage.
Well, Lauren, you treat a lot of patients here in New York, and you know, you perform blood tests on them. And isn't it a rarity to see a patient over the age of 50 or 60 who has very, very low inflammatory scores, has a low C-reactive protein or highly sensitive C-reactive protein, has a low level of a SED rate, a simple, you know, that's like a $10 test that can be performed on anyone easily. Or if you want to do a little deeper dive, you can look at IL-6 and, you know, various what are called cytokines. A lot of people are walking around in a pretty inflamed state to begin with.
Right. Exactly. And I think for our listeners, I think it's important to understand that, you know, inflammation should be divided into one thing. Like, most people believe, like, okay, I'm inflamed, my joints hurt, I got back pain, I have, you know, something of that nature, redness, swelling, and they say, well, okay, I have inflammation. But that is an overt level of acute inflammation, but it's the chronic long-term inflammation that you may not feel that is so contributory towards the disease process. And there is no disease process that we know of that doesn't have inflammation as part of its process. So this is no surprise that this is another one, except here the inflammatory process is the loci is the lung, and then it's a storm that occurs where the body's natural mechanism for inflammation runs rampant, and the lung can't compensate for the rate and the level of inflammatory process and fluid that it produces in order to try to expel this. And it becomes greater and greater, and that patient becomes hypoxic or can't get enough oxygen into their tissues, and they start turning blue, and now you've got a very, very serious problem, of which that is why they become intubated to be on a respirator. But the scary part is that the number of people that get on respirators that go that far don't fare too well.
And indeed, what, you know, some of the strategies that are being pioneered, and they're really, it's kind of an ad hoc effort, you know, all hands on deck, and especially in our New York City hospitals, and they're throwing virtually everything at these patients because some of them have very, very poor prospects for getting off the ventilator and surviving. But one of the strategies that they're employing, strangely enough, you know, we talk about boosting immunity. They're actually using powerful immunosuppressive drugs, some of these monoclonal antibodies that are used for rheumatoid arthritis, to tamp down the immune response. So it sounds like, on one hand, you know, we definitely want to increase our immunity so that we're more protected against the virus. But at the other end of the spectrum, when people are heading down that slippery slide towards death, we want to sort of put the brakes on over-exuberant immune responses and inflammation.
Indeed. It's interesting that while the chloroquinone increases the zinc into the cell and carries it in there, it, as a medicine itself, is an immunosuppressive medication.
Yeah, it's used in rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and, you know, skin conditions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that everybody jumped on it because it was the first few physicians who said, hey, this has a similarity to a malarial type infection. Why don't we try this? And they got some positive outcomes on it. And they were like, and then everybody ran with it because the truth is nobody knew what the hell to do.
Yeah, it was sort of a serendipitous finding. You know, I'm not sure how they figured that out.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, whether or not that drug is really the right one, even as a part of this process, it will be seen. The other thing is using the Z-Pak. I think it's being used more as to lower the inflammatory threshold, because clearly that's an antibiotic and this is a viral infection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not, obviously, these are not antivirals. There are some antivirals that they're using. But I'm intrigued by your comment that there are some genetic components to this. And I think that's actually going to be the basis for a lot of research on this. Like, why do some people get 4 plus sick and other people barely notice it? Is it genetic? I mean, we do see it concentrated in certain, among certain racial groups. Blacks and Hispanics, for example, seem to be sicker. I think they're just, even just for political reasons, I think there's going to be a great deal of research done to see if those populations are particularly at risk.
They do. Well, African Americans happen to have lower vitamin D levels than Caucasians.
So do elderly Spaniards and Italians.
The
people in nursing homes, they rarely get out. They get no nutrition at all.
Right.
You know,
and, if they're not supplementing, where are you going to get it from? I mean, you know, unfortunately, out of all the different vitamins that we can consume, both from food and from supplementation, you know, vitamin D comes from the sun, and the exposure that people get these days is quite poor.
And if you have dark skin anyway, I mean, what's the point? I mean, you're not, trying to achieve like a bronzed complexion because you're there already. Yeah.
Exactly. So one of the things that I had referenced was that defense barriers that we have actually require antimicrobial peptides, and they're actually activated by vitamin D. So if our D is low,
we
have one strike against us right there.
Yeah, the cathelicidin, which is, you know, activated by vitamin D, is a peptide that actually helps us. It's a defensin. It actually is a term for it in biology, that it's a defense substance, and vitamin D is really the key to production of some of these compounds. So, yeah, vitamin D certainly needs to be on board. I mean, there's actually been a call in some of the medical journals, like specifically the British Medical Journal, for research, because, you know, we're drawing all this blood on these people, and why can't we check vitamin D levels and do a study to see, you know, among the sickest patients, what were their vitamin D levels, and maybe do an intervention trial, give people vitamin D at the outset of this and see if they do better.
Right. So I had a conversation with our mutual friend, Dr. Gerard Mullen in Johns Hopkins.
Yeah.
And, he presented today to the hospital an RCT, which is a trial.
Randomized control trial. Yeah.
Right, a randomized control trial, in order to have the doctors there see the outcome on a short basis for the intervention of using certain nutrients like vitamin D and vitamin C and zinc incorporated with the chloroquinone. And we'll see what happens with that.
Because he's well positioned to do that, because he's a professor at Johns Hopkins, the Department of Gastroenterology. He's, you know, in the belly of the beast, so to speak. So he's got some suasion. And hopefully, as a faculty member, they'll say, okay, yeah, why not? Let's try it. And, you know, they're going to probably look a little askance at him and say, oh, yeah, there's that goofy guy who talks about vitamins and supplements. But, yeah, let's give it a shot, because what else have we got in our arsenal?
Yeah. So let's hope. But his whole point in producing this was to be able to take the patients that enter the hospital with this infection, and where they stage people when they come in. And so when you have the earlier onset, maybe you have chest pain, you have difficulty breathing, you have a fever, you have all the classic signs and symptoms, but you're not yet hypoxic where you need to be, because that's what's called a stage 2B. They go stage A, stage B, and so forth, and they stratify according to your symptom and your clinical presentation. And the key is, can we implement these strategies on those people prior to them becoming hypoxic, and can we change the tide of this disease by that intervention?
Indeed. Now, also, I mean, here, and you're well aware of this, is that there are some people who say, now, wait a minute, these things which are so effective at boosting immunity, oh, we've got to be careful, because if you don't want to boost immunity too much, because then we might get cytokine storm. We're over revving the immune system. What's your take on that? Because there's actually a lot of controversy among, you know, some of the top people in the field, and I'd like to get your opinion on this.
Okay, that's good, because if you're in our field, you know that this this quandary exists. And here's when you go into the literature and you start looking at these things, first of all, the first and foremost thing that you're going to see is that these things were in vitro studies. They were not in vivo studies.
Yeah. So, very few studies, and they're test tube studies, yeah. Right.
So they were not done on people for the audience. They were done in a test tube. That's one. And two is you have to, that's an extrapolation of data. That's number one. And what they do is they take that and they say, wait a minute. If that has the capacity to do this, then maybe that should be contraindicated. But the truth is that there's nothing solid in science, in peer review, that says that using substances like vitamin C and vitamin D and so forth is going to have the capacity based on the ability of that agent to rev up the cytokines to such an extent that it could produce a storm. And another one that was incorporated within that conversation was Sambucus or elderberry concentrate.
Yep, exactly. Right?
And as a matter of fact, I went on to, somebody sent me a link to take a look at Andrew Weil's site. And when that came out, he put that out there. And as of like yesterday, he's never retracted that information. Mm-hmm. A little disappointed because he is a science man. He ran with it as a counter. So anyway, I don't agree with it. And I think, it's quite safe. And, using vitamin C, whether you use 4 to 6 grams a day or whether you're, even going higher than that,
intravenous vitamin C at higher doses.
Intravenous vitamin C, you're not going to produce, you cannot, produce a cytokine storm with that. I'm completely against that theory.
And here's another reason I don't subscribe to that, at least when it comes to vitamin D, because vitamin D doesn't just work on one pathway of immunity. It has a whole panoply of pathways that it works on for immunity. So, for example, it is helpful for people with respiratory infections and other respiratory infections. It confers protection. But also, we sometimes give high doses of vitamin D to patients with autoimmunity, patients with multiple sclerosis, patients with rheumatoid arthritis, patients with lupus, patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And we actually find that in that capacity, where we have an over-exuberant immune system, in a way, a mild form of cytokine storm, we actually can tamp down the immune system with the vitamin D. So it really is, you could use the term, it's an adaptogen. When it's too low, it boosts immunity, and when it's over exuberant, it sort of reins it in.
Well, absolutely. I think the operative term here would be to create immune modulation.
Yes.
Rather than to use the term immune stimulating, because then you get into, well, if it could stimulate, it can overstimulate.
Yep.
Right? But modulation is the same thing as adaptogenic.
Yep.
Correct. Yeah. So Dr. David Brady wrote a Facebook post on that because he was pulling his hair out with people sending him the literature and going, you can create cytosine Zorman. He was like, you cannot.
And he's an authority I really respect. He's been very good on this subject.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking about referencing people that are true scientists and are looking at things in an appropriate fashion. Another gentleman who I have high regard for is Dr. Alex Vasquez. He is both a doctor and he is a nutritional researcher. And he wrote an unbelievable compendium of textbooks on inflammation and infection. And he calls it Inflammology, is his textbook. And he went on to explain, because vitamin A is another one that was considered, maybe we shouldn't use vitamin A at this time. And he really dug deep on a 20-minute presentation on LinkedIn, and anybody can look it up and find it. Dr. Alex Vasquez. He started out as a chiropractor, then he went to naturopathic school and became an ND, and then he went to medical school.
He's got a nut for punishment.
Yeah, exactly. But he's like a nerd guy, you know, mm-hmm. who just sits there all day. But he has a capacity as an academic that is just beyond me, you know. However,
Lisa, we have to rely on these authoritative people to, point the way.
He's looking at it. So he took a look at the relationship and the mechanism of how vitamin A relates to the measles. As this is a part of the treatment protocol for, and he broke it down to all the components and showing the relationship of both the influence of vitamin A on viral entities and on the pulmonary function, which the lung is so dependent on. And so he's really good at taking all of the research that has been done by really good peer-reviewed journals and looking at them and going, wait a minute. Don't just take it for face value just because some very prominent doctors, whether it be the British Medical Journal or the New England Medical Journal and so forth, just because they printed it and it got it published doesn't mean that the data is always correct.
So he kind of looked behind the data.
And he looked at it and he said, wait a minute, what's the sample size? What are the dosages? And what he found very often when it comes to nutritional interventions and studies was that the dosages that were used were subpar to the implication. And one of those substances was N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, right? It's a phenomenal agent that we use in nutritional medicine.
Can I just interrupt you for a second? Because we divide our podcast into two parts, and I want to start on the topic of N-acetylcysteine and glutathione support, because that's a whole other aspect of this. I want to give it full discussion in part two.
Please.
So when we return, our guest, Dr. Lauren Marks, having a delightful conversation with him as we both experience lockdown, and we're looking at the COVID-19 pandemic and nutritional implications for it. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.